Hello, this is Hugh Baird. I'm your moderator for this evening's discussion. I'm here with State Senator Art Haywood and his guests, and we want to welcome you to this live telephone town hall. If you have a question for Senator Haywood or his guests this evening, you press star 3 on your phone's keypad at any time. Again, if you have a question for Senator Haywood, you press star 3 on your phone's keypad. Now I'd like to welcome Senator Art Haywood.
Thank you, Hugh. And thank you to all of the area residents participating on tonight's call. Some of the best feedback and ideas I have received come directly from these calls. I'm Senator Art Haywood, and I'm holding this live telephone town hall where I am joined by my very special guest, Dr. Ruth Abaya, pediatric emergency physician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. We will discuss gun violence prevention, and we'll answer any questions you may have. This format will allow you to listen in and even ask a question from the comfort of your home. If you'd like to ask a question at any time, press star 3 on your phone. Now, let me introduce my guest, Dr. Ruth Abaya. Dr. Abaya, please share with us a little bit of your background and why you're on the call with us tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Senator Haywood, for this invitation, and thank you for the ability or the opportunity to discuss our perspective as practitioners of pediatric emergency medicine and advocates for child health on this very important subject of gun violence prevention. So my experience and exposure, as you mentioned, I work in the pediatric emergency room. I'm also a fellow of the CHOP Violence Prevention Initiative. And my passion is in violence prevention in young children and adolescents. We have noted in the past several years a growing body of research that tells us how we can help children avoid gun injury. And what we want to do is translate that research into action and give families, legislators, and everyone who advocates for child health in any sphere the opportunity to contribute to that effort with us.
Great. Glad to have you on the call.
Thank you, Dr. Abaya. Senator, before we begin the call, and I know we're having folks join us as we go along, I know you have a couple important, you have a very important policy hearing coming up early on in Philadelphia in a week or so. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that for those that have joined us and perhaps enlighten them about what you're going to be speaking about at that event.
Thank you, you. On Valentine's Day, February the 14th, we're having a Senate policy hearing on reducing gun violence. It will be held at LaSalle University from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. More information can be obtained at my website or call my office. SenatorHaywood.com is my website. And we have some local as well as national speakers who will be able to tell us, A, what some of the challenges are for survivors of gun violence, and two, what we can do to prevent it in our neighborhoods. Some individuals will talk about the urban violence that's in our streets. Others will talk about the violence in our schools. And so I'm confident and I'm really excited that we'll have a tremendous conversation, get some ideas that we can implement in Philadelphia and Montgomery County and throughout the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I encourage everyone who's listening to attend. I'm really encouraged by the high quality of speakers that we will have and that we can have a conversation that can move our city and state forward.
Thank you, Senator. Again, that's the Senate Democratic Policy Hearing. It's on February 14th at LaSalle University from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Again, if you have a chance to the opportunity to go there, it would be very enlightening. Before we move to the callers, Dr. Bai, can you talk a little bit about what you see as some of the challenges in dealing with pediatric gun violence and the issues that you see coming into your practice?
Absolutely. So I think it's useful to lay a landscape so people have a sense of what the burden of gun violence is nationally and also locally. So there are between 30 and 40,000 gun deaths in the country. In 2017, there were 39,000, which is about 12 per 100,000 people. And this doesn't this is not an epidemic that spares, unfortunately, children. So we see upwards of 3,000 deaths in children as well. The majority, about 60%, are homicides, and about a third are suicides. In Pennsylvania in particular, we saw over 1,500 firearm deaths in 2016, which is a rate that's just a little bit above the national average, and about 7% of those deaths occur in children. The numbers tell volumes, but I think that what's most powerful is the experience and the stories of the patients that we're privileged to care for. We see a spectrum of things that come into the emergency department, from minor verbal altercations that escalate rapidly with the introduction of a firearm. We see children who are at risk for suicide and gain access to a firearm with devastating consequences. And we see accidental injury in very young children who are shot by peers or as bystanders. And we also see children who are victims of intimate partner violence, where a firearm significantly increases the lethality of those incidents as well. And so the spectrum of disease is broad, but we believe that the tools of public health that we use to fight flu epidemics, that we use to fight motor vehicle collision epidemics, are just as applicable in this context. So there are a number of initiatives and policies that we think make sense in caring for children in particular. As far as the things that work, we think that research and evidence should be the basis for any policy that is enacted in any either local or national intervention. Hospital-based violence intervention programs can help to both gain the knowledge and the access and the data that lets us kind of build policies that last and intervene in points of violence before they escalate to the point of firearm violence and death. So we know for a fact, for example, that youth that are victims of assault are at a 40% increased risk of subsequent firearm violence. And that's powerful knowledge because we see those youth in the emergency department all the time. That gives us an opportunity to wrap around services that give them the tools to deal with that violence and the stress related to that violence, the trauma related to that violence with nonviolent means. So those are the types of initiatives that we support. Those are some of the things that we think definitely can work. As far as barriers, there are a number of barriers that make it difficult to protect children from the consequences of gun violence. Child access prevention is one major area. We know for a fact, and evidence has supported the fact, that securing firearms, making sure that they are stored locked and unloaded, is protective for young children and also for adolescents who may be at risk for interpersonal violence or suicide. So giving families that information as well as the tools to secure the firearms that they own is a way to protect children. Disseminating that information and making it mandated by law, I think, is something that can protect children in any location, but is definitely a difficult thing to do and is done variably throughout the country. Other barriers, I think sometimes it's hard to overcome some of people's reactions to discussing firearm violence. And so we believe that discussing it as a public health issue keeps us all on the same page. Everybody wants to keep children safe, and we believe that that's an area of common ground that we can build upon.
Well, Dr. Abaya, thank you very much. Senator, before we go to the callers, just a reminder for those that have just joined us, if you have a question for Senator Haywood this evening, you press *3 on your phone's keypad. He has a special guest this evening. It's Dr. Ruth Abaya from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. We're discussing gun violence. Senator, would you like to begin by going to the calls?
Yes.
Okay. Senator, our first caller tonight is going to be Mike. Mike, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood and Dr. Ruth Abaya.
Hi, Mr. Haywood and Doctor. I have a question that relates to gun violence in terms of a true dialogue. I believe that I'm personally a hardcore liberal, and I believe that the gun violence has gotten so out of control that the solution is just so simple. It's to eliminate guns. If you look at Great Britain per capita, the number of murders so much less per capita compared to the United States. And I feel like if you ask certain Democrats like Nancy Pelosi, okay, what are we going to do about gun violence? In her heart, she would probably say, make it illegal. Let's make it illegal. But she's so scared of the backlash and the NRA that you hear the Democrats saying the usual, oh, we'll make reforms. You know, maybe we can make it safer if we do this or that. And it none of these things work. And the other thing I can't stand hearing is that, oh, it's a mental thing. If a person didn't have a gun, that meant they would just grab a knife and do the same thing. Well, a person is more likely to probably outlive a knife attack than a gun attack. And as the doctor was saying, what you're seeing is a lot of people who don't even have it within them to kill, just killing people, because the gun gives the opportunity to people who probably weren't even thinking about it. So my question to you is, you know, are you interested in having a real dialogue about getting to the point where one day guns are literally eliminated from the streets, made illegal, or do you think that it's just going to continue as the same discussion of fear of the NRA, and so Democrats are just going to say the same old thing, like reform, but they're never going to go near that word of eliminate the Second Amendment? I believe the Second Amendment infringes upon the First Amendment. The First Amendment,
I got you.
Freedom of speech and rights. And if you can't walk into a movie theater and see a movie without being shot, I'm referring to that Batman movie where everyone was shot, then that means the Second Amendment infringes upon the First Amendment. And
I understand, Mike. So let us respond. I think we understand both sides of your question. And let me respond to the legal question, and Dr. Bai can respond to the mental health knife versus a gun impact on in terms of violence. In terms of the Second Amendment, I and many others are not for elimination of the Second Amendment. In fact, in Pennsylvania, under the Pennsylvania Constitution, an individual has the right to bear arms for the self-defense. So I don't think that we have to go as far as saying eliminate the Second Amendment or repeal the Second Amendment in order to create an environment that is safer for our children and adults. And many of the solutions that we have proposed, such as having firearm licensing and safe storage, have proven to work across this state. In fact, across the nation. And there are states in this nation, California, New Jersey, and others, which have more strict regulation of access to guns. And as a result, the shootings are less, as well as the deaths are less. So I have evidence that stricter gun laws do work. And that, I believe, is the first step to increasing the safety of individuals. But Dr. Bai, I know he raised a question about knives and guns, and what do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So what you're referring to, I believe, is the lethality of guns. And I think that there are some legislative actions that address that point. So, for example, many child protection advocates have spoken in support of the limitation on assault-style weaponry for a while. And the reason is, I think, a lot of what you're alluding to. So the ability to do a large amount of harm in a small period of time poses a threat to children. And the idea that we're trying to keep children and youth safe in our environment suggests that we should be thoughtful about the way those types of weapons are controlled. I do think, I completely agree with Senator Haywood, that there is good evidence that if we are thoughtful about the way that we advocate for storage of, licensing of, and regulation of firearms in various locations, we do see a decrease in unintentional deaths and intentional deaths, homicides, and suicides as a result. So, for example, child access prevention laws in states that have had them for at least greater than a year have been demonstrated to have a reduction in all three of those areas. And so when a gun is stored securely, we have a demonstrable effect on the safety of children in that environment. So I do think that there are concrete steps that can be taken that will have an effect, that don't feel like they're ineffective. But also don't make people feel that their fundamental rights are challenged.
Well, Mike, thank you very much for your question. For those who have just joined us, if you have a question for Senator Haywood tonight, you can press *3 on your phone's keypad. That's *3 if you have a question for Senator Haywood or his guest, Dr. Ruth Abaya. Senator, before we take the next caller, I'd like to introduce our one of our live poll questions this evening. And the question that you can participate on the call. The question is, do you support firearm licenses that include fingerprints of the owner? If you do, you can press 1 on your phone's keypad. If you do not, you can press 2. Again, the question is, do you support firearm licenses that include fingerprints of the owner. If you support that, you can press 1 on your keypad, and if you do not, you can press 2. Again, if you have a question for Senator Haywood, press *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, can you go back to the callers?
Yes.
And we're going to go to Wendy in Glenside. Wendy, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Hi. My question is for the pediatric emergency room doctor. And the question is, what is the role of the pediatrician or a primary care doctor when patients come in for a general checkup? What is the role of the doctor in preventing gun violence? And do you recommend asking patients if they own a gun?
Thank you, Wendy. That's an excellent question. So the role of both the pediatric emergency medicine physician and the primary care doctor, I believe, is to provide families with what is known to be effective to protect their children. So the ability of physicians to counsel on safe storage is, and also to provide guidance about what that means practically, I think cannot be disputed. So for example, there have been studies that show that a lot of families who own guns are not aware that their children, even first and second graders, know where those guns are in the home. And some of them have handled the gun, up to a third in one study had handled the gun. And this was in direct opposition to what those families believed to be true. So families want to know that type of information because they're obviously interested in keeping their children safe. The best time to do that is in that general pediatric well visit, when nothing has happened, before any trauma has transpired, because we want to prevent injury, we want to prevent harm. And so doing that at every opportunity we have, whether that's a primary care visit or an emergency room visit, I think is extremely important. As I mentioned before, if you've been assault injured or if you've had exposure to violence, you're at increased risk. And so again, we have an opportunity for prevention when we're counseling or caring for youth and children that have been exposed to violence. That's a key opportunity to counsel. And then finally, I just want to mention that mental health screening for suicidality, for depression, is extremely important, because when we identify youth and adolescents who have a risk of suicidality and we identify that they also have the means, that is an ability to prevent a true tragedy. We know that suicide is upwards of 90% successful in regards to a lethal outcome in comparison to other methods of suicide attempts. And so identifying patients who are at high risk and giving those families counseling is, I would argue, the obligation of a pediatrician.
Senator, would you like to add?
I think that's the exact answer that I have three children. Of course, at one time they were going to a pediatrician, and parents want to know any solutions, any advice that can help increase the safety of their children. And whatever a pediatrician may know, whether it is on vaccinations or safe stories of guns, that's what we want to hear from the pediatrician, because I can tell you from my own experience, any advice that we get that can help maintain the health and safety of our children, that's what we want to hear. So I'm so glad that you shared that, and glad to get the question from Wendy.
Wendy, thank you very much for the question. Again, for those of us just joined us, if you have a question for Senator Haywood this evening, press *3 on your phone's keypad. That's *3 on your phone's keypad. Our live poll question going on right now is, do you support firearm licenses that include fingerprints of the owner? If you do, you press *1 on your phone's keypad. If you do not, press 2. Senator, we'll go back to the callers. We're going to go to Ms. Burgess in Philadelphia. Ms. Burgess, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Yes, good evening, Senator. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. I'm calling. I have two questions. One is about the gun violence of so many of our young, people that are just, doing the wrong things with having guns. And how can they get them, and how they get them in the first place? Because it's not just, it's got to be more than just a signature of being approved to get a gun, but there's a lot of other ways, as we know, that children and young people can get a hold of guns and use them in a bad way, and too many lives are being taken. So I think it has to start back in the homes also, that so many, you know, the parents need to know what their children are doing out here, and the things that are happening in school are getting so bad that you kind of make you not want to even send your children to school, because it's, you know, just too much of the gun violence, and where the guns are coming from is another, is a very big issue on how do we go about controlling that.
Okay. So let me respond. We are very aware that there's too many illegal guns in our communities. And unfortunately, many of the illegal guns have been traced to purchases in some states that are around us, where it's even easier to get a gun than here in Pennsylvania. One of the things that has been recommended is that we have background checks for guns. But more importantly, a lot of guns, unfortunately, may be purchased by someone who is eligible to buy a gun, and then they turn it over to someone who's not permitted to get a gun. For example, we have seen photos of women and men getting a gun and then going out into the parking lot and turning the gun over to someone else who we suspect is a felon or someone else who can't not buy the gun themselves. So we've got to be better at enforcing the laws to make it clear that you can't buy a gun for yourself and then turn it over to someone else when that gun sometimes, often, unfortunately, ends up at the crime scene. We can restrict the supply. We can restrict the availability of these guns that are often on the street by having much tighter enforcement of these gun resales. So I think that's one way that we can be about decreasing the number of guns that are in our neighborhoods, the easy access. The firearm licensing poll question comes from my legislation. And here's the basic idea. If you have to have a license to get a gun, and you have to have your fingerprints provided, then it's much more likely that you will be accountable for that gun, much more likely that you're not going to resell the gun. And there are a few states in the nation that require the license and require the fingerprint, and in those states, the guns violence is down. You know, we got to have a license to drive a car. A gun is much more lethal than a car, and a license, I believe, is entirely required and will make people who have guns, I believe, much more accountable. That's what the evidence shows. Thank you, Ms. Burgess.
Doctor, would you like to add anything? Dr. Abaya?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes. Would you like to
yes,
add?
Yes. No, I
can.
I was just saying that I completely agree. I think that there are a number of measures at the point of sale that make gun owners accountable, both for the purchase of the gun and then for the maintenance of the gun, for reporting the gun if it's stolen, all of which helps control the flow of guns onto the streets. And so I completely agree.
Ms. Burgess, thank you very much for your question. If you have a question for Senator Haywood, you can press *3 on your phone's keypad. That's *3 on your phone's keypad. Tonight we're discussing gun violence prevention with Dr. Ruth Abaya. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Laurel. Laurel, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Hello. Thank you very much for this the talk on the phones. I am a former Cub Scout counselor, and back in 1984, when the subject of guns came up, I was a Cub counselor at the camp. I queried the boys ages 8 to 10 about guns in their homes. I live in Orlin. This is Montgomery County, and this is a fairly affluent suburb, Springfield Township. Of the 90-plus boys in the camp that summer, only two had no guns in their homes. We live in an arsenal of guns. I queried the boys about where the guns were. They were all locked up. I queried them about where the keys were. They all knew where the bullets were. They were separate from the guns. They knew where they were. later, years later, when the same age group was in college, I was auditing a class out at Lock Haven. I'm talking to them about my experience in Cub Camp, and the boys were laughing. These were college boys now. Yes, they had played with the guns, and their parents weren't home. I believe no locked gun cabinet can keep a child out that's determined to get in. I went to the parents at the time that I was involved with the Cubs and had a meeting with the PAC. The mothers seemed to be very impressed that their husbands had guns. The state trooper came in to speak about gun safety and said as long as there were no bullets in the guns, there was no problem. I grew up in South Jersey on a farm where guns are a fact of life because you need them on a farm to kill animals that are distressed and have no way of living other than dying a miserable death. And we had a state trooper come in every year about gun safety, and he said a gun is always loaded. You're never pointed at anyone. I believe we need more gun safety in the schools, and we need parents alerted to the fact that their children have access to locked guns in locked gun cabinets, and there is nothing they can do about this except get the guns out of their homes. That's my statement. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I got to tell you, I was also a cub master, and I'm very familiar with actually what the young people know that the parents are not aware. The children know much more than what the parents are aware of. And safe storage has had some success in the states where it has worked, but certainly getting the guns out of the home is safer. Than pretty much any other measure that we could come up with.
Dr. Rabai?
I completely agree. So I never cease to be amazed by how creative and curious children are. And I think that while we're certainly impressed, we're also alarmed because I'm sure all of those parents thought that they were doing the best thing for their children and would have been alarmed to find that these measures that they have enacted in their home were not effective. And that completely goes with what researchers told us. A lot of families are surprised to find that children do know where the guns are and have handled them in the past. So I think that your experience coincides with what the research tells us. It also coincides with what we know about child development. Children are extremely curious. They do like to explore, and they don't tend to kind of stick within the limitations that we give them. And so I think we need to be a little bit more conscious of what we know about normal child development when we enact plans for firearm safety. And that changes as children age. And so how you're going to counsel a family with a 2-year-old about gun safety should be different from how you counsel a family with a 15-year-old. And that information needs to be provided to everyone in the home. There's also research that shows that two adults in the same home may report different things about how the guns in that home are stored. So the mother may believe that the gun is locked and unloaded and that there's no ammunition in the house. Lo and behold, there is, and the father or another caregiver knows that, and the child also knows that. So sometimes who you have sitting in the office across from you is not the only person who has knowledge of the firearms in the home. So counseling has to be effective. I also wanted to mention that there are some existing kind of training curricula around how to tell children to handle guns safely. And as you alluded to, those are limited. Children tend to do something different when you ask them what they do with guns than when you observe them, for example, on a camera in a research setting. And so we need to be more knowledgeable about how children develop, what they're interested in, and what they're actually doing, and our behaviors should reflect that. Studies as early as the 90s have demonstrated that the safest home is a home without a gun, unfortunately for children. That continues to be the case. But there are indeed safety storage tools that have been shown to at least reduce injury. And providing families with both that counseling and those devices is an important part of prevention.
Laura, thank you very much for that question. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. But before we do, just a reminder, if you have a question for Senator Haywood this evening, you press *3 on your phone's keypad. That's *3 on your phone's keypad. Senator, we're going to go to Robert in Germantown. Robert, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, Senator Haywood and Dr. Beyer. My name is Robert Lee, okay? My question is, during the time that a gun is purchased or during the time an application is filled out to get a gun permit, is it possible that on those applications, with two separate entities now, whether it be, I give you an example, like the Philadelphia Police Department has a unit that where they will issue you a gun permit. You know, you pay and so forth and so on. It asks questions. If you go and then you buy a gun in a gun store, maybe have it added on that application. Do you own a gun lock? And if the person answers no, okay, then that would that should be part of one of the requirements to purchasing a gun or getting that gun permit to get a gun lock, okay? I understand that, you know, they would have to come out of pocket to buy that gun lock, but make that, you know, in addition to having a gun locker, you know, at home, a safe or what have you, if a lock is on there, that's an extra precaution because it doesn't matter whether the gun is loaded or isn't loaded. If you put the gun lock on there, you cannot squeeze that trigger. Okay? And, and again, my question is to add that on the application.
Thank you, Robert. And I strongly agree that requiring gun locks as well as safe storage should be a requirement at the point of purchase. Yes. And that is the point of the transaction where the gun goes into the home or into the car. And it's at the point of purchase that the gun lock and safe storage should be enforced. So you got to buy along with purchasing the gun. You got to walk out with a gun lock and a safe storage device. That's the kind of legislation that we need that I think would be helpful. And I thank you for that idea. I think it's a good one.
Doctor, do you have anything to add?
I agree. I think the point of sale is a really ideal opportunity to address all of the safety issues that could stem from the purchase of that gun. And I think it's just an opportunity that isn't always captured. So I completely agree.
Well, Robert, thank you very much for that question. For those that have just joined us, I wanted to remind those listeners that, and Senator, we'll go back to this, but you're having there's a gun violence, a Senate Democratic policy hearing on February 14th at LaSalle University from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Again, we mentioned that before, but I know there's some folks that just joined us. And for those that just joined us, if you have a question for Senator Haywood, you can press *3 on your phone's keypad. Before we get to the caller, Senator, I want to move to our next live poll question, which is, do you support a ban on assault weapons and ammunitions? If you do, you can press 1 on your phone's keypad. If you do not, you can press 2. Again, that question is, do you support a ban on assault weapon and ammunition? If you support that, press 1 on your phone's keypad. If you do not, press 2. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Aisha and Wincott. Aisha, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Hi, Senator Haywood. This is Aisha Fairfax. I really wanted you to be able to speak to just some of the gun safety legislation that we are working on in Pennsylvania.
Certainly. Thank you. Glad to hear you from Wincote.
Yeah, very good.
She's from my home. So there are a number of pieces of legislation in the Pennsylvania legislature that are being considered. Two have the best chance of passage. First is what's called the extreme risk protection orders. This would allow a family member to go to a judge and say to the judge, my relative has a serious mental illness or a mental situation, and he at this moment, he or she at this moment, is a threat to themselves and to those that are around them. Now, the judge would have to make a decision about whether to agree or not agree to take the gun away for some temporary period, not permanent. So these risk protection orders are in a number of states, almost passed in Pennsylvania last year. It's got a good chance of passing this year. Second is the requirement for universal background checks. We have background checks almost universally in Pennsylvania already. But there's a small area where an individual can buy a long gun, a rifle, at gun shops, gun shows, more private sales. So we want to close that loophole so we have complete background checks required for handguns as well as shotguns and long guns. In addition, senators have proposed the assault weapon ban and the ammunition ban. Senators have proposed the firearm licensing. I propose that so that you've got to get a license before you can get a firearm. Safe storage is under consideration. So there are a number of pieces of legislation under consideration, but the risk protection as well as the universal background checks have bipartisan support, Republicans and Democrats, so I think that has the best shot of making it all the way through this year.
Dr. Abai, is there a specific piece of legislation or a series of legislation that you've seen within your practice that Senator Haywood mentioned that you're more strongly in support of and your organization supports?
So I think it's useful to talk a little bit about child access prevention laws, which we mentioned previously. So obviously these are focused on children, and what they do is they put the responsibility for safe storage on the adults in the room, on the gun owner. And these have been demonstrated in multiple states, states that have kind of different gun cultures and different rates of firearm violence. We've seen reductions in multiple types of gun injury in children. So child access prevention laws, and the strongest ones, mandate that a gun be stored safely regardless of whether or not that gun is ever accessed by a youth, and regardless of whether any harm is actually ever perpetrated with that gun, the responsibility is on the gun owner to store that gun safely at all times. Massachusetts is an example of a state that's enacted this successfully. So I think it's useful to continue to push for laws that mandate safe storage in any home or any environment where children are present.
Well, Aisha, thank you, Dr. Aisha, thank you very much for the question. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers, but before we do, one more opportunity to vote on the live poll question, second live poll question today, which is, do you support a ban on assault weapons and ammunition? If you do, you can press 1 on your phone's keypad. If you do not, you can press 2. And if you have a question for Senator Haywood, you can press *3. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Mary in Melrose Park. Mary, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Hello?
Yes, Mary.
Yes. Senator Haywood, I'm
yes.
Living in Melrose Park. I got a child living in, go to school today to Montgomery County. My question, we don't want to sit down to see our kids die in the school system. I want to know how we can stop that. How we can secure the school system, especially in Montgomery County, why are we pay that much money for the school? Because our taxes, they make us pay a wage taxes in Montgomery County. That's a good question. I want to know how we can secure the school system before something happens.
Thank you, Mary. I'm paying the same taxes. I understand where you're coming from. So in terms of securing the buildings, we in the Commonwealth set aside $60 million across the state so that schools can improve security. Some of that included changing doors and changing access, providing cameras. And so there are a number of solutions that schools in Montgomery County are taking to make it more difficult for an intruder to come in and shoot, kill, or injure the children. In addition, some of the funds we provided were not just for making it more difficult to get into the building, but also to provide some counseling to young people who may be on the verge of doing something that's outrageous. School superintendents from across the state came to us in the Senate and said they needed more resources for counselors to help and talk to the young people so they wouldn't get into the most dangerous position. So those are the two sides of what we have done. A, making it, some of the buildings less accessible, which is somewhat of a challenging situation because we want school to be in a nice, comfortable environment that's conducive to learning, and then on the other side, providing more resources for the counseling of young people. I know that the Cheltenham School District has applied for some of this money so they can participate, and I believe that will be the case throughout the county and throughout the entire Commonwealth.
Doctor, you have anything to add?
Yeah, so that question really strikes us to the core, doesn't it? As a mother, I completely empathize with that sensation. School should be a safe place. And it's very difficult for parents to hear the stories we hear of school shootings and feel safe in their own locations. I think it's really important to also note that while school shootings make up a minority of child deaths due to firearms, the effects definitely reverberate. We saw patients come in with traumatic stress reactions and acute anxiety in the wake of the Parkland shooting, even though it was several states away, because it really affects a place that we assume is safe, and that affects our perception of safety in our environment, and that has long-reaching effects. I completely second supporting mental health services in the school, recognizing that children who are exposed to violence and even patients who or students who are struggling with mental health issues deserve that support, and that could be a strong preventative measure. We mentioned before the importance of banning assault-style weaponry because those are the types of guns that are often used in school shootings and are able to cause a significant amount of damage in a short amount of time. So I think that is a piece of the puzzle as well. It's also worth mentioning that although there has been some conversation about the presence of guns in schools as a protective measure in the care of security personnel or in teachers, there's not any evidence at this time to support that particular measure. And we know in general that the presence of guns in places where children work and play can increase their risk of gun violence. And so we don't currently stand in support of those types of measures. We also think that there are other kind of microaggressions that happen in the school setting. So addressing bullying, addressing the counter effects of bullying, addressing kind of low-level assaults that occur every day in school settings. I think that talking to those patients and talking to those students and giving them a different narrative to confront those interpersonal challenges also helps to prevent these bigger, more traumatic and terrifying events. So thank you for your question. I think it's an important one.
Mary, thank you very much for your question. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Patricia. Patricia, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Yes, good evening, Senator Haywood. I live in Mount Airy. My name is Patricia Amachi. And my question is this. Coming to the Constitution, we as people know that the First Amendment is the freedom of speech. However, that is a question when you speak of something that someone else doesn't like. That takes away your right constitutionally. Number two, my question to you is this, dealing with the Second Amendment, which is the right to bear firearms. All right? I am a person who's totally against firearms, even on a police officer, but that's their job. My question, I haven't gotten to it yet, but I have to say this. When it comes to the Second Amendment, just as they've taken away the First Amendment, when you have something to say and people lock you up for it, why can't you pass a bill or an amendment to try to change the Second Amendment to bear firearms? Everyone in our surrounding should never be allowed to have a firearm. That should be the police department. That should be officials that need it. That should be maybe farmers who do need to eat. Other than that, I think the Second Amendment is allowing people to kill. Now,
thank you.
I want to know how you feel about that.
Thank you. So, this is the second person, you, Patricia, along with Mike, who have recommended the elimination of the Second Amendment. And here's something I would like to share with you. In our last call, we got a little bit of a sense that there are people throughout Pennsylvania who own guns, and there are not instances in their counties of shooting or homicide. There are 67 counties in Pennsylvania, and the high level of shooting and the high level of homicide are in five or six of those counties. So I got to share with you, there's a number of places across this state where firearms are not connected with homicides. They're connected with sporting. They're connected with farming. And so it's because that firearms are not universally used for shooting or for homicides that the approach of taking all the guns away in all the counties is challenging when many of the counties are not really having the same kinds of effects from the firearms. And this is in part why the laws that make safe storage required, the laws that would require allow a person to have a gun taken away if they're in a certain kind of mental state, laws that require firearm licensing, they all restrict or further regulate how we use a gun. But I got to share with you, there's many places across this state where the use of a firearm is being conducted by responsible adults who are not involved in any crime whatsoever.
Patricia, thank you very much for your call. Doctor, do you have anything to add on the Second Amendment?
I think I largely stand in agreement with – hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. I stand in agreement with Senator Haywood. I think that it's important to focus on how we can prevent harm. There are over 350 million firearms in the country, and this is a durable item. And so although it could be easy to assume that the reduction of firearms in general would be a solution, unfortunately, it's not a very tenable one. And so focusing on how we can provide the appropriate restrictions to promote health, to promote safety, especially for those who are the most vulnerable among us. There are legislative actions that can do that, that have been demonstrated to be effective. And I think that that is where the money is at present.
Well, Patricia, thank you very much for your call. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. But before we do, I'd like to get into our third live poll question. That question is, do you support a law that requires safe storage of guns at home? If you do, you can press 1 on your phone's keypad. If you do not, you can press 2. Again, the question is, do you support a law that requires safe storage of guns at home? If you support that, press 1 on your phone's keypad. If you do not, press 2. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers. We're going to go to Catherine from West Oak Lane. Catherine, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Yes. Good evening, everyone. My name is Kathy Reddick, and I live in West Oak Lane. I just have one question. My question is, shouldn't it be mandatory that all schools in the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania area be equipped with gun detectors in the entrance and the exits in the buildings in the schools?
Thank you for that question, Ms. Reddick. And there are some schools that do have the metal detectors so that an individual, so we can, you know, detect whether someone's got a gun or any kind of anything that's metal. However, it's not clear to me that should be in every school in the Commonwealth. Every school district gets to make their own decisions about these rules. There are 501 school districts in Pennsylvania. And I do believe that each school district should be in a position to assess what's going on in their location and make a decision about what's appropriate for those schools. I do want to share that Philadelphia is the biggest school district in the state by far. We've got about 200,000 young people. The next largest school district is in Pittsburgh with only about 60,000, much smaller. And there are many school districts much smaller than that. And I think that each of those school districts should have that local authority to come up with what they think is best.
Catherine, thank you very much for your call. Senator, before we go to the another caller, I want to go to a submitted question. And this question is for Dr. Abaya. It's from Jordan. And the question is, Dr. Abaya, can you please talk about how mental health access or lack thereof is impacting gun violence? is violence prevention initiative working on that issue?
Thank you so much for that question. I'm delighted to have an opportunity to talk about that because that's a subject about which we as pediatricians are passionate. So absolutely, mental health services play a role. And we know for a fact that there are insufficient services for the students and for the patients who need them. We often screen for behavioral health risk factors in the emergency department and in primary care, but that's not something that's necessarily universally done. And unfortunately, although you may identify patients with mental health needs, there aren't always sufficient resources to meet those needs. We have a philosophy in pediatrics recognizing that there is exposure to chronic stress in the environment that leads to toxic stress. And so these are children who are at increased risk of both physical, health-related, and mental health downstream effects because they're chronically exposed to violence and to other environmental risk factors like poverty. And providing support for that early on, we believe could be preventative for gun violence and a number of other things. But unfortunately, the resources are not adequate to do that. So in answer to your question about what the CHOP BPI philosophy is on this, so mental health services are absolutely a part of the violence prevention model. For example, we have a VIP process by which children who are victims of assault are captured at the moment that they present to medical care, so in the emergency department, and are given wraparound services so that they are given aid to navigate the mental health effects, the physical health effects, law enforcement needs, social support needs, for themselves and their family going forward from that episode of assault. The goal is to interrupt the cycle of violence and to create a different narrative, and the mental health support that they need to do that is an integral part. And so I don't think that we can do the work of violence prevention, you think specifically about suicide, for example, without thinking about mental health. I think that that's a very important piece. It is not the only piece. It's necessary but not sufficient, but I think that when we talk about providing services to children and to adolescents to help them mitigate the effects of toxic stress and violence in their lives, mental health has to be a part of that.
Jordan, thank you very much for submitting that question. Senator, can you talk a little bit about any of the initiatives here in the General Assembly that you're aware of deals with increasing mental health funding and resources that are available?
Sure. So we passed, as I mentioned briefly earlier, $60 million for school safety last summer. Part of those funds are going toward providing mental health and counseling supports in our schools. But I fully agree that there's a long way we've got to go in order to fully support and address the serious mental health challenges that people have, young people and not just young people. This is an agenda where, again, we've got a long way to go. I do want to say this, though. I believe there's been some mischaracterization of the extent to which people who are committing crimes seem to be labeled, particularly in the assault weapons situation, as those having a mental health challenge. And there's no evidence, there's no reported evidence that I've seen, and Dr. Beyer, I'll yield to you, but there's no reported evidence I've seen that indicates that those who have mental health challenges have a higher propensity, are more likely to shoot or more likely to kill someone. And so I'm a little bit concerned about some of the stigma that's created around those who have mental health issues and connecting them automatically to shooting. I don't think that those who have mental health conditions are probably any more likely to be involved in a shooting or homicide than those who don't have these same concerns. But Dr. Baez, is that what the evidence shows?
That's an excellent clarification. Thank you. So, yeah, Senator Haywood, it's absolutely the case that actually people who suffer from mental health conditions are actually more likely to be victims of violence than they are to be perpetrators of violence. And so there is a risk for stigma. And the idea behind mental health services is not to say we need to provide services because all of these individuals who struggle with their mental health are at risk of being perpetrators of violence, but rather to say that there's a there's an environment of stress that increases the risk of both perpetration and victimization by violence. And that's the cycle that we want to interrupt. I do think you're right. I think that it is it's easy to immediately characterize all gun violence events as being secondary to mental health, and that does create some undue stigma that needs to be addressed.
Jordan, thank you again for submitting that question. That was an excellent question. Senator, we're going to go back to the callers now. We're going to go to Denise. Denise, go ahead. You're live with Senator Haywood.
Yes, good evening, everyone. Personally, yes, I do think that children that have, that have mental problems, they have a big tendency to be violent, okay? And a lot of it starts in the home, okay? Our children today, for what I can see, are angry. If you try to say something to them, they don't want to listen to you, or they have something smart to say to you. So they're not being taught discipline in the homes like they should be, because if the children was taught discipline in the homes, that's a start right there. Okay. What another problem I think started all of this violence with kids and all like that is because they took all of the activities out of the schools, okay? There was a time when kids can go to music lessons, art lessons, sports after school for the boys, or dancing for the girls, or home economics. Those things were taken out of the schools. So the children they're not being taught to, they're not being taught to mingle and get along with other kids. When you had these activities at the school, children mingle with each other, they learn from each other, and they were kinder to each other. Now all they have is this social media, to me, which is a bigger problem, because they seen all this stuff goes on social media, and if one of their friends say something to them they don't like, then it goes into a big argument. Now they want to retaliate, and how do they retaliate? With guns. And this is because they don't know how to communicate. They don't know how to communicate with each other because they're not being taught to communicate in the home, and they're not being taught to communicate in the schools. You have to give kids something to do in school besides, even at the classes, they need some type of activity. And the reason why I can say that, because I know that's what happened with me and my friends when we were young. We didn't have anything to do. We were bored. We go around and knock on people's doors and run.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's because we didn't have anything else to do. But once they put that community center in our neighborhood, where I personally took ballet lessons and home economic classes, and, I mean, we went on trips, we went camping, and so it changed my whole life. And also the lives of my friends, and we talk about it today, St. Paul Community Center, when we were young. They had all those activities for us to do, and so it changed me. And I wasn't an angry child, but I was bored, and I didn't have anything to do, so I had a tendency to get in trouble.
Understood. So thank you, Denise, and let me say this. Having productive activity to engage young people is a core part of the solution. Whether that's Cub Scouts, whether that's sports, whether that's mentoring at a rec center, whether that's chess or drill team, having young people engaged in these kind of activities is critical. Some cities have even gone as far as teaching conflict resolution, that's nonviolent conflict resolution, in the schools, particularly in the middle schools, so young people have a better facility, better capacity, more experience with dealing with conflict in a way that's nonviolent. So this nonviolent training, getting young people involved in productive activities so they're not on the path to delinquency are very much part of how we can get our young people on a path toward productive citizens. Now, I do want to share that there's some of this activity still going on. I'm 62 years old, and I benefited from a lot of activities as a young person. But I can say being in Northwest Philadelphia as well as Montgomery County, there are a number of sports activities for young people. We're trying to grow Cub Scouts in the area and Girl Scouts in the area. And the rec centers are very good, but obviously they need more programming. Part of the responsibility for creating these opportunities, clubs, dance, trips for our young people, has to come from the adults in the community. Our generation has to step up, in my opinion, and provide a place where the young people can have productive and entertaining opportunities. And so we have a shot to make a difference for the young people in our communities. And it's up to us to intervene and give them something productive to do so they can build a life. Now, I want to say one final thing in this regard, then I'll yield to Dr. Baya. We had a forum with young people ages 15 to 25 in the summer of 17. We talked to them about gun stories. What they said to us is that what would help them reduce gun violence is mentoring. They wanted guidance. They wanted someone to help them make the crucial life decisions they have to make. This is what the young people asked for, mentoring. Now it's up to us to stand up and provide the guidance that the young people are asking for.
Dr. Baya?
So I completely agree. And what I like about your point is that you're acknowledging, you're recognizing how violence doesn't occur in a vacuum. It's part of this need for safer communities as a whole. So when we address violence, we have to talk about the context. What else are children being given to do? What other supports do they have? What are their streets like? What are their neighborhoods like? What are their parks like? And how do we take those elements and make them part of the work of violence prevention. Going into the schools and giving young people the opportunity to be peer mentors, I think, is a really key element. So there are a few signature programs of the Violence Prevention Initiative, for example, that focus on interpersonal relationships and bullying among children in the school setting. And a lot of them help them learn how to be positive bystanders, how to not participate in a cycle and a culture of violence and aggression. And I think that those are some examples of ways that we can empower them to feel like they're part of the solution, which I think is an important part of gun violence prevention as well. I definitely agree that giving youth the ability to use all of their talents, whether they be athletic, whether it be arts and sciences, whatever it is that children are interested in, we want to provide those opportunities. And it seems removed from violence prevention, but it's not at all. It's definitely part and parcel with these safer community approaches that we've been discussing. So thank you for that question.
Denise, thank you very much for that question. Senator, we're coming down the home stretch here. I'd like to do some housekeeping before we move on to conclude, but I just wanted to go back over our live poll questions and the results this evening. The first question we asked, do you support firearm licenses that include fingerprints of the owner? That was supported by 96% of those who participated. 4 were opposed. Second question was, do you support a ban on assault weapons and ammunition? That was supported by 92% of those who participated, and 8 were opposed. And the third was, do you support a law that requires safe storage of guns at home? That was supported by 88% of those who participated. Senator, I know we're coming down the stretch here. You have concluding comments and those from Dr. Abaya.
Thank you so much. I want to thank everyone who participated in this telephone town hall discussion, to those who listen in for those who shared their opinions and asked questions. This has been a great discussion. I want to specifically thank Mark, Mike, Wendy, Ms. Burgess, Aisha, Mary, Laurel, Robert, Patricia, Ms. Reddick, Jordan, and Denise for raising these questions for us to address this evening. And especially, I want to thank Dr. Ruth Abaya, the pediatric emergency physician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Thank you so much. It was great to have you on this call. Now, if you didn't have a chance to ask your question, please remain on the line. You'll be able to leave your question on a voicemail for me, and we will get back to you. Thank you for your participation. If you have any additional questions or concerns, please call my office at 215-242-8171. You can also visit my website at senatorhaywood.com. Dr. Abaya, do you have any concluding comments you'd like to share before we say goodnight?
I just want to thank all of you. Thank you, Senator Haywood, for inviting me to be part of this conversation, and to everyone who participated and called in, and for those who are working on this important issue of gun violence prevention in our communities. It can't be done without families and community members. And so I want to thank you for your questions and for your concern for your work in protecting children.
Thank you, Dr. Avaya. Thank you, Senator Haywood. And I just want to express my thanks for those who participated in Senator Haywood's telephone town hall. You've been a wonderful audience, and have a good evening.